This is Regionally Speaking on Lakeshore Public Radio. I'm Chris Nolte. Abby Omadunbi is a vice president and he's an economist with PNC Financial Services. And we check in with him every month to find out the latest of how the economy regionally and nationally is doing. And Abby, thanks for joining us on the program today.
Thanks for having me again, Chris. It's good to be back.
Well, if you will, fill us in first, your assessment of how the regional economy here in Northwest Indiana is doing.
The regional economy has benefited from very strong global demand for steel and iron ore in the past year. Mm-hmm. Steel prices reached record highs in the first half of this year, mainly due to pent-up demand and also due to some supply disruptions at many steel mills. So Northwest Indiana leads the country in steel production, and the boom in steel prices really benefited the economy. Looking forward, I'm very optimistic about the prospects for the regional economy. I expect continued growth as vaccination rates increase and consumers get opportunities to spend their stimulus payments.
I know there have been a lot of anecdotal reports lately about labor shortages. Why are we seeing this, and how much longer do we expect such reports to last?
That's a great point, Chris. So there have been many reports of labor shortages, many reports of companies giving potential employees hiring bonuses in order to employ them. There are a couple of reasons why we've been seeing these reports. First, mainly due to the unemployment benefits, which we've had since the pandemic started. So this has reduced the incentives of many workers to return back to work. Another reason why we've been seeing some of these labor shortages has been because of just the fear of contracting the virus or spreading the virus. So many folks aren't returning back to work because, you know, we're still in a pandemic. Mm-hmm. Things have improved, but we're still far from normalcy. But I do expect that, you know, the labor shortages should ease in the next 6 to 9 months. So as the pandemic subsides and vaccination rates improve, and as, kids go back to school, you know, that would also help people, you know, return back to the labor market. So I expect the labor supply issues to improve in the next 6 to 9 months.
And we've heard now about the regional economy. What is PNC's current national economic outlook? What should we expect in the second half of this year?
So I'm very optimistic about the national economic outlook. The job numbers, a couple of weeks ago were very strong. The U.S. economy created about 850,000 jobs last month in June. This was the strongest month of job growth since August 2020. So we continue to see strong job growth in the leisure and hospitality sector as the U.S. economy reopens and, you know, folks feel more comfortable congregating in public. So I expect the pace of job growth to accelerate in the second half of this year. I expect there to be, you know, very strong economic recovery and strong growth. And, you know, we're also seeing very strong earnings in companies, particularly cyclical companies, and that's very indicative of a healthy economy. So our baseline forecast calls for about 6% annualized GDP growth this year. And, we expect much faster economic growth in the second half of this year.
Now, I know we've had the latest on Consumer Price Index report this morning, and we're expecting an update to come on Thursday on retail sales. How are we looking on consumer confidence these days and about the concerns about inflation?
Right. So the concerns about inflation are very valid. So we've seen very high inflation numbers in recent months. But again, that's mainly due to first supply disruption, and also due to comparison with last year. So last year there was absolutely no demand. So comparing the prices this year with last year, we get very high prices. But I expect inflation concerns to get better over, mm-hmm. over the year as supply improves, as manufacturers are able to produce more, and as the pandemic subsides. So I expect inflation concerns to ease in the next 6 to 9 months.
Abby Omadunbi is a vice president, and he's an economist with PNC Financial Services, and is with us on a monthly basis to bring us up to date. And Abby, thank you for being with us today with the latest update, and we'll be back with you in August. Thank you very much.
Thanks so much, Chris.
The American Red Cross tells us they are experiencing a severe blood shortage as the number of trauma cases organ transplants and elective surgeries rise, and that in turn depletes the nation's blood inventory. We see the increase in these procedures because more patients are able to get back to the hospitals or their doctors, and because the pandemic is starting to abate. To find out more about the impact here in Northwest Indiana with all this, we have the Executive Director of the American Red Cross Northwest Indiana Chapter, Kristen Marlowe, with us. And Kristen, thank you for joining us at Regionally Speaking.
Chris, thanks so much for having us. Appreciate that.
This is a very serious time. We've had these shortages before, but it seems that they come out in much more frequency, certainly because we couldn't donate blood because of the pandemic, right?
Yeah, definitely COVID has had its impact in so many areas, but blood collection has certainly been one of them. Typically, summer months, we do see a decrease in number of donors presenting to give blood. That's because more folks are traveling, people are going and visiting family and friends, and no time more than with COVID allowing folks, you know, we're coming out of some of those restrictions, people have been vaccinated and they're starting to move around a bit. We're seeing that just as impactful this year. And then also because of some of the restrictions that we had during COVID, as you said, elected surgeries that were being postponed, folks are now getting back to getting those scheduled. And we also see a significant number of collections needed for trauma centers. That right now is being increased. We've got trauma centers increasing the need, increasing by 10% in 2021, which is more than five times the growth of other facilities that provide blood transfusion. So traumas and emergency room visits, overdoses resulting in transplants, those types of things. So very, very important for anybody that can donate blood to do so this summer.
If you will, to folks that are not familiar with how the process goes, what do hospitals get to do as they find the need for blood? Do they get to draw from a blood bank, so to speak, with the American Red Cross or other organizations? And it's just that bank dwindles in supply because of the need?
Yeah, that's correct. Everything goes into the nation's blood bank and the national blood supply. The national blood supply is actually part of our national security. You know, we can't support the American people and the need for life-sustaining blood products without the without donors rolling up their sleeves and providing that. So watching the level of the nation's blood supply is a critical component of the work that we do. And so donors, when they go into to donate blood, it does go into not just the Red Cross inventory, but it goes into the National Blood Bank. And it can be pulled anywhere across the country. You know, obviously, we want to make sure blood is as close to the need as possible. So from a logistics standpoint, you know, the blood raised here traditionally and typically should stay here unless it's typed and is a very rare match, in which case blood donated here could potentially fly across the country and save a life on the other side of the nation. So anything that's collected here goes into the National Blood Bank, not just for the Red Cross, but for all blood centers that that inventory there.
I see. What kind of impact have the fewer elective surgeries had? We know that at some point here early on in the pandemic last year, about this time last year or even earlier, the hospitals had to say we can't accept any people coming in for elective surgeries because primarily at the time it was because of the virus. But I imagine, too, that there's some point that's because of the amount of blood that's needed.
Yeah, that's definitely true. One of the things, Chris, we're seeing in regards to that as well is now that elective surgeries have opened up and people are feeling a lot more comfortable getting back to standard medical care. That's another reason why we're seeing a great demand for blood, because the patients who previously deferred care during COVID now present with more advanced disease progression and therefore require increased blood transfusion. So, you know, some folks that potentially might have been able to go for standard care a year ago, the delay in receiving that is also one of the reasons we have an increased need of blood supply available to the hospital.
Have you noted any big increase in the need here from the hospitals and other healthcare units here in Northwest Indiana in particular?
Yeah, what we're seeing, again, hospitals have an atypical number of traumas in the emergency room. That's not just here in Northwest Indiana, but that's a national increase that we're seeing right mm-hmm. now. So the numbers that we're seeing here in Northwest Indiana are typical with what we're seeing across the country in regards to, number of, and keep in mind, we also have an opportunity where folks are feeling a lot more comfortable to travel and move around a bit more. As I said earlier, you know, we've seen that trauma center demand increase and climb by 10%. Yeah. 20 to 40% of those trauma deaths occur after a hospital admission that involves massive hemorrhaging, and the doctors in those facilities, whether it's the hospital or the trauma center, they need to secure a blood supply to fight the odds. And in order to save a life in these dire circumstances, when I'm talking about that, you know, trauma death, hospitals need to secure hundreds of blood products depending on the severity of the trauma. So they need to make sure that there's products on the shelf ready to go and kind of in standby, if you will. And the more we start moving around as a population, the more opportunity there is for more of those traumas to happen, those critical car accidents and things like that. So, it all just kind of compounds at the same time to say, not only do we need to stand ready by having those blood products in inventory, we need the blood donors to step forward and roll up their sleeves to make sure we have that. The only way the blood bank and the nation's blood supply is replenished is with an individual rolling up their sleeve and donating blood. Mm-hmm. Blood products cannot be manufactured.
Okay, let's talk about those donations now. Let's go through, I guess, what you could call the frequently asked questions. What types of blood are needed? And how does somebody set up an appointment to be able to make a donation? And what actually happens for people that have never donated blood and need to maybe allay some fears about that when they go in to get their blood drawn?
Sure. Honestly, one of the biggest reasons people don't give blood is either nobody's asked them to, or they're a little fearful. They're a little scared. So as a blood donor, I can walk you through firsthand exactly what that process looks like. Best way to donate blood is to just go into a blood drive at a fixed site, or what we call a mobile drive. A fixed site means it's either an American Red Cross or another blood center's standard office, and they're open, you know, standard hours, Monday through Friday or on the weekends. Mm-hmm. A blood drive location would be at your local church, or your Knights of Columbus Hall, or your VFW, or just any local community partner that hosts what we would call a mobile site, where they're setting it up temporarily for the day for folks in that community to have convenience to go and donate blood. Whole blood, one unit of whole blood, has an opportunity to save up to 3 lives. You're going to donate one unit of blood. It's going to take approximately 4 to 8 minutes for that blood collection to be done. You're going to be there probably closer to a half an hour by the time you get checked in and they get you situated on the table and, put the needle in your arm. That's part of the process. Don't be afraid of it. It's a little pinch. And then afterwards you get some juice and, you know, cookies or crackers or something like that. But the actual process of the blood donation is usually 4 to 8 minutes. So it's not very long. But once that unit of blood is collected, it has the opportunity to save up to 3 lives, because it will actually be broken down into 3 different blood components. It'll be broken down into red blood cells, into platelets, and into plasma. And they all have a different function. A lot of folks don't realize that platelets is what causes your blood to actually coagulate and actually clot, so that you can assist your body in healing. And that is given very often to cancer patients and folks that are going through chemotherapy. Platelets only last about 5 days. They have a very short shelf life. So if you've got someone that is going through cancer treatment and they require platelets as part of that treatment, they can only receive those platelets if somebody rolled up their sleeves within the last 5 days.
And I understand, too, that all blood types are really needed now, but some more particularly than others.
Yeah, you know what? Right now, all blood types are needed, particularly O. And again, those platelets are a big deal. And again, those are pulled out of any blood donation. But less than half of the blood supply is type O in the recent weeks. And there is currently an emergency need for type O donors. The type O is the most needed blood supply by most hospitals, because it is typically the one that can go untyped and is a little bit more universal when it comes to the application to the patient. So If you are a type O blood donor, I'm speaking directly to you. Please challenge yourself. If you aren't a current blood donor, consider giving blood. If you can't give blood, ask somebody to donate on your own, on your behalf. You know, the life you save may be yours or a family member's. You know, we never know when we're going to need that blood. But if you do know that you are a type O, yes, please consider donating.
And the website address is www.redcrossoneword.org/Indiana if you'd like more information. And we thank you very much, Kristen, for joining us and telling us about this important need of severe blood shortage that's needed by the American Red Cross. And we hope that we'll have updates from you soon. Thank you.
Thanks, Chris. Get you sharing the word.
Kristen Marlowe is the Executive Director of the American Red Cross Northwest Indiana Chapter. And you're listening to Regionally Speaking on listener-supported Lakeshore Public Radio. From being questioned about COVID-like symptoms to test results to vaccinations to having our temperatures taken by employers and businesses where we patronize, people want to know what is and is not off-limits these days. Well, the short answer is it's complicated. We're talking about HIPAA, which are the privacy laws that we're all facing these days, and it was before the pandemic even, and COVID-19. Well, what can businesses ask? And for that, we are turning to two experts who have studied long and hard on this subject. We have Indiana University Northwest Professors of Health Information Management, Linda Galosi and Dorinda Sattler with us today. And ladies, thank you very much for being with us on the program.
Happy to be with you. Thank you for having us.
Well, we're talking here about HIPAA, and as I mentioned earlier, it's been around long before the pandemic, of course, with other issues involving healthcare privacy and the like. Dorinda, since I guess you're more of the specialist in the issue of privacy laws, will you explain for people that don't know what HIPAA is? They hear that term all the time, but what is HIPAA, and what organizations are basically covered by it?
Sure. So HIPAA, otherwise known as the Health Insurance Portability and Accountability Act, it's really a very large law inside of which are the privacy and security rules that deal with protected health information. And the privacy and security rules only apply to institutions known as covered entities.
Mm-hmm.
And these are certain health plans, certain healthcare providers, and healthcare clearinghouses. So I think it's important to know that not every healthcare provider is a covered entity, only if they perform certain electronic transactions like billing your insurance company for the services they provide to you, if they bill for those services electronically. So it's covered entities that deal with healthcare. So this excludes the restaurants that you visit, the stores where you purchase goods and services.
Does it seem, Linda, that that is part of the confusion that we have and maybe some of the misinformation that has gotten out there, certainly since the coronavirus pandemic hit?
I think so. You know, businesses that I've noticed lately, a lot of businesses have signs posted on their door that you're asked to wear a mask if you have not been vaccinated, but it's up to you if you have been. And I think a lot of people kind of feel like their rights are being violated. And I've heard individuals call out, well, that's my right under HIPAA.
Mm-hmm.
And that's not exactly true. You may feel like your privacy is being violated to a certain extent, but it's not covered under HIPAA. So it's not a HIPAA violation.
Now, since you focus primarily on data and security, especially, mm-hmm. essentially, and that's, of course, a big concern these days with cybersecurity issues that we know have been well publicized, mm-hmm. and not necessarily in healthcare issues, but are we finding that this particular area is even more sensitive because of the pandemic, maybe more than ever?
I'm not sure that security has been heightened because of the pandemic, but I think it has exposed the flaws in cybersecurity of our software. And that goes back to, you know, that extends to medical devices and not just our computers themselves. I think this pandemic has just exposed a lot of flaws in our healthcare system, you know, all over the place.
Now,
I can add something to that as well. Throughout the pandemic, the Office for Civil Rights, which is within the Department of Health and Human Services, they have put out numerous bulletins throughout the pandemic to guide covered entities on how they can deal with the privacy and security of health information related to COVID treatments and so forth.
I was going to ask that because we have all of these very complicated privacy laws that we've had to deal with many for years here because prior to the pandemic, and it's just gotten worse because of the pandemic and all the places that people can go now in particular. Are there ways, I guess, we can simplify it, if it can be done, as to letting people know, number one, certainly we have the CDC guidelines telling us where we can and can't go, what we can and can't do, at least during the pandemic. But when it comes to dealing with businesses and employers in particular, are there ways that we can kind of simplify or at least better categorize what citizens, the average person, should know that they can or cannot do?
Well, I think that just remembering the type of institution that you're frequenting is going to be responsible under different sets of laws. Mm-hmm. So unless you're seeing a healthcare provider or you're dealing with your health insurance, then most likely HIPAA is not going to apply. Businesses and employers have other sets of laws that they are subject to. So I don't know that there's really a way to make it less complicated for the public in general. What I would say is that if you visit a healthcare provider, that you do take time to read the notice of privacy practices that they try to give you when you do visit.
Yeah, I have done that before, too, when I've gone to the doctor or gone to the clinic to be checked out for something or another. And even when I go to the lab to get blood draws, I sometimes will take a look to see what is covered here within the privacy laws. Not that I think that my laws or my privacy is going to be violated, but it just seemed to feel a bit more at ease, I suppose, if you know the procedure is going to not be publicized to everybody in the world.
Sure. And in addition to that, those notice of privacy practices inform you, the patient, of what your rights are. There are certain rights that are afforded to you as a patient related to your protected health information. So it's good to know what those are, too.
If we may, ladies, let's talk about some of the situations that the average person would go through, certainly maybe have already and needed to be clarified on, or maybe you found out by getting in trouble, I guess, or being warned about the situation. What about a situation, we'll take it first at home with the family members. What can family members or friends of the family, what can they know about a particular situation or a condition? Or even for that matter, the most important one right now is to whether you receive the COVID-19 vaccine. What can you say or cannot say?
Linda, you want to take that?
As an individual, you are able to tell your family and friends anything that you would like. It's the provider or the person who administered the vaccine that should not be telling your family or friends that you have received the vaccine or that you have or have had COVID. So, you know, what you want to tell your family and friends, that's completely up to you.
Mm-hmm. Does that also...
But it's the provider's responsibility to make sure that they are not passing that information along.
Now, does that pertain also to the card that everybody's received? If you receive both of your doses of the vaccine, and you have that card from the Indiana State Department of Health that you're supposed to keep track of, keep in a safe place, does that information on that card pertain as well, too?
Yes.
That's probably one of the simplest answers, I suppose, you could probably ask from anybody, I would imagine. But it does.
Yes.
Because I know that there's...
Yeah, the card was provided by, most likely by a HIPAA-covered entity. And so that information is protected health information. And so then it's up to the individual who received the vaccine to, you know, protect that card, protect that information. Let their primary health care providers know that they've gotten the vaccine. That's very important for them to know.
Mm-hmm. Now, we've talked about this, I guess, momentarily here about it, but let's bring up the subject of businesses and retailers that a person may visit for goods or services, whatever, and they're not covered, I understand, as covered entities. So what kind of situations do you find yourself in there if they happen to ask you that, you know, to wear a mask if you're not fully vaccinated?
Well, businesses have an obligation to protect their clientele, to provide a safe working environment for their staff. So they are well within their rights to ask patrons to mask up if they haven't been vaccinated.
Mm-hmm.
And while that may infer if somebody's walking into an establishment and they see the sign that says, please wear a mask if you're not vaccinated, by inference, you can look at someone and see that they have a mask on, and maybe you can determine that, wow, they're not vaccinated, or you're going to assume that someone in the establishment without a mask has been vaccinated. This isn't a violation of privacy, even though the vaccination status may be inferred, assuming that the individuals are masking up truthfully or not masking up truthfully.
Right.
But if the establishment would then say, well, why aren't you vaccinated? That's, even though that's not a HIPAA violation, that's really something that they shouldn't be asking people. It's really, your health status is none of their business. But what is their business is that you are safe to be within their confines around their other patrons and their staff.
I understand. I suppose it's more of an abundance of caution as well as trying to follow some sensible guidelines.
Right, exactly.
Mm-hmm. Now, how about for an employer who happens to ask an employee for information that they may need or put in your personal, in your office record? How does that fit into the privacy laws?
Well, employers, just like many employers require other vaccinations of their staff, or they may have you take a pre-employment physical, your COVID vaccination status, in my opinion, is really no different. Employers, they want to make sure that their workforce is healthy and is safe for, again, other workforce members and for their patrons. So it isn't a violation of privacy. It isn't a HIPAA violation if they ask you to be vaccinated or to provide or to indicate whether or not you've been vaccinated.
Are we going to find, Professors Glossy and Sadler, that as things get better, as the pandemic lessens, more people are vaccinated, more precautions helping to cut the number of cases and unfortunately deaths that go along with COVID-19, are we going to find that things will get maybe a little less strict? Now, the privacy laws are going to be in place regardless, I guess.
Yes, they'll always be in place. They mm-hmm. had been in place prior to the pandemic. I just think, again, the pandemic has heightened what we know or what we don't know about HIPAA privacy in healthcare. So this was just an explanation to provide the facts of what HIPAA does and does not cover.
Mm-hmm. Well, hopefully it will clear up, at least in some people's concerns, about what the privacy laws cover and the like. And I know that that it comes down to basically, I guess, rights in a way, to be able to decide what information you can share and with whom. And the nice thing is that there are laws, in this case it's HIPAA, because that's the way it's been set up for other cases in healthcare especially, that will help protect you and protect everybody else that you're around.
Right. And I think there are two important things for individuals to realize. First of all, they determine, for the most part, what information they can share and with whom. Now, granted, there isn't 100% control of that when you're in a hospital or you're receiving healthcare services, because there are certain other individuals and entities that need to know what's going on with you so that you can be cared for safely and appropriately. But for the most part, you decide what you share. And secondly, individuals should educate themselves, and they can do that by going on to the Department of Health and Human Services website. There's, if they just Google HIPAA, they can find the HHS.gov website that talks about HIPAA for patients. And that's, that website has a wealth of information, and it relays it in layman's terms.
Well, Professors Linda Galossi and Dorinda Sadler, who are both professors in health information management with Indiana University Northwest, thank you for spending time trying to make some sense out of all of this. And we hope that that at least in covering some of the examples and concerns and getting some of the questions answered, and hopefully clear up some of the misinformation, that we've made it easier for our people to understand where the federal privacy laws fit in with the average person, especially as we're dealing with the pandemic. Thank you very much, ladies, for being with us today to talk about it.
Well, thank you very much for having us.
And that's it for Regionally Speaking for today. I'm Chris Nolte. Thank you very much for being with us, and we'll be back with you tomorrow.